From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The woman the world knows as the French chef is American cook Julia Child. On this edition of Fresh Air, Julia Child tells us how she learned classic French cooking in Paris, then returned home to teach it to Americans. Randy Schiltz is considered the leading journalist on the subject of AIDS. He's covered the epidemic since 1982. Coming up, Schiltz gives us an update on the latest medical research, and he tells us why he's decided to stop writing about AIDS. And film critic Owen Gleiberman has a review of the new thriller, Die Hard 2. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. NATO leaders meeting tonight in London are considering new proposals that could change decades of Western alliance doctrine. NPR's Jackie Lydon reports.
President Bush came to the NATO summit with an armful of ideas for the allies to consider. NATO is still vital, he said, because free nations must stand together before an uncertain world, and because collective security is better than national rivalry. But knowing the Soviet Union is looking anxiously at this meeting, the president suggested Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev attend a future summit meeting. The president's ideas for moderating NATO's nuclear doctrine and the timetable for various nuclear arms cuts and cutbacks of military troops received a generally friendly reception. But there are differences between the NATO allies, which will be worked out into the long hours of the night before a communique is issued tomorrow. I'm Jackie Lydon in London.
British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher was one of the strongest opponents of the change in nuclear policy, but her aides indicated later today that she would probably go along with it. West German officials welcomed the proposal. The dissident Czech playwright who helped lead the country's anti-communist revolution last year has been re-elected as Czechoslovakia's president. Václav Havel was named to a 2-year term today by an overwhelming vote of the Czechoslovak parliament. Havel was the leader of the Civic Forum coalition that overthrew the ruling Communist Party last fall. He was elected to an initial 6-month term as president in December. The number of people taking refuge in embassies in the Albanian capital, Tirana, has grown considerably during the day, with reports that as many as 1,300 may now have gained access. Pierre Vickery reports.
Hundreds more Albanian refugees have managed to obtain access to foreign embassies in the Albanian capital, Tirana. Despite a heavy police presence in the area around the diplomatic compound, people scaled walls and climbed trees to gain entry. But in contrast to Monday, when the Sigurimi fired on the demonstrators, there were no immediate reports of violence. Meanwhile, the Albanian Foreign Ministry has issued a statement promising that all those inside the embassies will be given permission to leave the country. This would satisfy calls both from the United Nations Secretary General, Perez de Cuellar, and the European Commission that the Albanian government honour its recent commitment to improve human rights. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
Stock prices fell sharply today, ending a week-long advance. Analysts say investors are waiting for the results of corporate earnings reports for the second quarter of the year, due out in large numbers over the next 3 weeks or so. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 32 points to close at 2,879.21. Volume was a light 128 million shares. This is NPR News. Real estate tycoon Donald Trump made an early tax payment of nearly $14 million today, a week after his bankers agreed on a short-term loan package to save him from bankruptcy. Trump was one of New York City's 400 biggest landowners who were given a midnight deadline for their July property tax installment. The early deadline was set in an emergency measure aimed at helping New York City ease a cash flow crisis. Mayor David Dinkins signed the measure into law this afternoon, saying it was necessary because of short-term financial problems created by the state legislature's late action on the budget. 5 art museums in Paris closed their doors to visitors today following the theft of 3 paintings in 3 separate museums there yesterday. A painting by Renoir was taken from the Louvre in broad daylight. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
French officials said the 5 museums were closed to tighten security. Yesterday, Renoir's portrait of a seated woman was cut out of its frame at the Louvre Museum. Within hours, two works by lesser-known artists were stolen from other museums. The Louvre stayed open, but the director of National Museum said security arrangements there would be tightened, though he refused to elaborate. Just how the Renoir was stolen in the middle of the day with the museum full of visitors remains unclear. The museums which did close today are small, and each focuses on the works or collections of an individual. Police suspect the three thefts carried out yesterday could have been the work of one group or individual who had moved across the city center from one museum to another. So far, police have no leads on the stolen paintings. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
The president's son, Neil Bush, has been ordered to appear at a public hearing on his actions as an officer of a failed savings and loan association. The Office of Thrift Supervision has ordered Bush to appear before an administrative law judge to explain why, as a director of a thrift, he approved loans to a business partner. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. With the 1961 book Mastering the Art of French Cooking, Julia Child helped introduce Americans to classic French cuisine. In 1963, she started her long-running TV series The French Chef and became one of America's most celebrated cooks. Child's seventh book is called The Way to Cook. She addresses herself to the new generation of cooks who didn't grow up in the old traditions. Child told me that attitudes about food have changed since the 1960s when her first book came out.
Well, they've changed enormously. In the 1960s, you could eat anything you wanted. And, of course, people were smoking cigarettes and all kinds of things. And there was no talk about fat and anything like that. And butter and cream were rife. Those were lovely days for gastronomy, I must say. And then along came, in those days, too, it was classical French cooking, and you didn't deviate from the rules. But now, and then shortly after that, we got, in the 1970s, we got Nouvelle Cuisine, in which a lot of the old rules were kicked over. And then we had Cuisine Minceur, which people mixed up with Nouvelle Cuisine, but was actually fancy diet cooking. Then we went into the organic phase, where we had bean sprouts and tofu, to a large extent. And now we're in a kind of a fright situation where people are very much afraid of fats and oils, and cholesterol has reared its ugly head.
Are you afraid of cholesterol?
I think cholesterol has become such a trendy word now that I think a lot of people really don't know what it's all about, but they just know that they're afraid and they're eating oat bran and getting diarrhea. Or some people are. So I hope we're going to get out of the silly season and get back into some good sense, because you're supposed to have a certain amount of fat. 25% to 30% of your calories should be fat or oil, because you need to process your vitamins, and if you don't have enough fat, they won't do you any good.
Well, have you cut down, though, on the desserts and sauces?
Well, I have always tried to eat sensibly, mm-hmm. and I think it's the good word is moderation in all things and a little bit of everything. And I would be a Mrs. 6x6 if I ate all that I like, so that I've been pretty sensible and I've been watching my weight, because mainly for cosmetic reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But in my new book, I'm trying. I have all our main recipes are mostly very low in fat and calories, and then you can add what you want. But it's written for mature people who know what they're doing. And as most people say nowadays, that you, for one thing, inheritance is terribly important. You should know what your family background is.
I'm interested about the foods that you grew up eating. Mm-hmm. Now, you grew up in Pasadena, California.
I did indeed, and I grew up in the teens and the 20s when most people had, middle-class people had maids or had someone to help. And we had very sensible New England-type food, because my mother came from New England, roasts and vegetables and fresh peas and mashed potatoes. But nobody discussed food a great deal, because it just wasn't done. And there was no wine served at the table, at least not in my family, who were very conservative. We always ate very well, but it wasn't talked about.
Well, your family had a cook. Did your mother cook at all, and did you learn to cook at all?
No, she really didn't cook at all. She knew how to make baking powder biscuits and Welch rabbit, and that's all she knew how to make. And I didn't do any cooking then, at all.
Did you have any interest in cooking?
I was always very hungry, but I never did any cooking at all. And it wasn't until I went over to China in World War II. I was with the OSS, and I just adored that Chinese food. It was so delicious. We were in Kunming and Chongqing. And then I met, there were a lot of sophisticated world travelers whom I met, and food was discussed a great deal. And then after the war, when I married and settled down in Washington, D.C., I began to cook and found that I enjoyed it immensely.
Mm-hmm.
It always took me a very long time. I had Gourmet magazine and The Joy of Cooking. And then we found ourselves in France, and I can remember my first meal there. We had come over on the boat, because that was in 1948, and airplane traffic was not rampant, or it hardly existed. And we had our big old blue Buick on the boat and drove from Le Havre to Rouen. And I remember my first French meal. It was just delicious. Of course, we had wine, which I had not known much about, and oysters on the half shell, and then a beautiful dish of sole in white wine sauce with mushrooms. And I just couldn't get over. I hadn't ever had that kind of food.
Sounds very good. Before we continue about life in France, I want to just back up a little bit and go back to your childhood for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
You're over 6 feet tall,
mm-hmm.
so I'm sure you were a very tall girl.
I'm the smallest in my family.
Oh, no. were you very athletic, and did you...
Oh, very, uh-huh. Yes. I played tennis and golf and all kinds of things. I was very, very athletic, because one was in California anyway, because you could do outdoor activities.
Were you comfortable with your height, or were you self-conscious about it?
Well, I didn't like dancing school when I was much taller than the boys, but I don't know. I got used to it perfectly easily.
Mm-hmm. Julia Child is my guest, and she has a new cookbook called The Way to Cook. When you graduated from college, you went to New York with the hopes of becoming a novelist or of writing for a magazine.
Or writing for The New Yorker, or at least getting into Time or Newsweek. Nobody wanted me for some strange reason.
Why did you want to write, and were you sure that you wanted to have a career?
Well, I was. I thought I was romantic about the idea of writing or being on the stage. In those days, too, everyone was fascinated with the theater. But I wanted to do one or the other, and then I got a job at W&J Sloan's furniture store in advertising and publicity, which I enjoyed very much.
Mm-hmm.
And then along came the war, and I went down to Washington and eventually got into the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS.
Did you want to be a spy?
I did want to be a spy, and I thought I'd be a very good one, because no one would think that someone as tall as I would possibly be a spy. But of course, I ended up doing office, menial office work. I was in the files the whole time, it was fascinating as an organization to be in, and at least I knew everything that was going on.
Did you feel that you were discriminated against because you were a woman, and that's why you were doing
clerical work? Those were in the days before women's lib, and women were not expected to do anything but eventually marry and have children and be good wives. I don't know exactly why we went to college, if that's all we were supposed to do. But just nobody thought of having a career except a few people who were doctors, but I don't think there were very, very few people who ever went into law, because you wouldn't get anywhere as a woman.
Well, you were telling us how being in the OSS led you overseas. You lived for a while in China. I think you lived for a while in India.
Yep. Ceylon. It was Ceylon in China.
Mm-hmm. And then after the war, you're telling us you went to Washington, then went back to Paris, mm-hmm. went to Paris and lived there. This was in the late 1940s.
Mm-hmm.
So you had wonderful food in Paris. Food.
Oh, it was just marvelous. It was still the old classical cuisine. It was just delicious. I've never had such good food again as we had then.
Well, how did eating wonderful food lead you to want to start preparing wonderful food?
Well, I was very much impressed with the food, and I just had, having started in cooking after we got married, I decided I would go to the Cordon Bleu, and they had kind of a classes for what we call fluffies. What it did at that same time, they were having some classes for the GIs on the Bill of Rights, and I decided after doing a little bit that I would really like to do much more serious delving into cuisine so that I was able to join the GIs. And they didn't object, luckily. And we started in at 7 in the morning and finished at around 11. And then I would rush home and prepare a fancy lunch for my husband, Paul. In those days, too, the American Embassy followed the two-hour lunch, French lunch hour, so we always came home for lunch. And then, but in those days, too, middle-class women were not going into cooking, either the French or the Americans. And the French, of course, all had maids. It was the way we had lived before the war in the USA.
So the other students were mostly chefs?
So nobody, no people that I knew, either French or American, were at all interested in the mechanics of cooking. But then at some party through a mutual friend, I met my colleague Simon Beck, Simka, who was, as I was, tremendously interested in cooking, but she knew a great deal about it. She'd worked with old Henri Pellepas and so forth. And eventually, because we began working together, eventually we started a little cooking school called L'École des Trois Gourmands, and Simka and her friend Louisette were writing a book on French cooking for Americans, and they needed a collaborator. So that's how eventually Volume 1 of Mastering came into being.
Mastering the Art of French
Mastering
Cooking.
Mastering the Art of French Cooking, you know.
Well, I want to talk with you more, but first we have to take a short break. Then we'll be back, and my guest is Julia Child. She has a new cookbook, which is called The Way to Cook. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Julia Child, when you co-wrote Mastering the Art of French Cooking, did you see it as a way to introduce Americans to French cuisine?
Yes, I was tremendously interested in French cuisine because it's the only cuisine that has the real rules on how to cook. And I wanted, because I had started in quite late. I was about in my early 30s when I started cooking. And I found that the recipes in all the books I had were really not adequate. They didn't tell you enough. And I won't do anything unless I'm told why I'm doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt that we needed fuller explanations so that if you followed one of those recipes, it should turn out exactly right. And that's why the recipes are very long, but they have full detail. And my feeling is that once you know everything and have digested it, then it becomes part of you.
When you moved back to the States and you wanted to continue French cooking, were there ingredients that you couldn't find in the States?
No, there were some differences. I think the cream was not as thick, but that was easy enough to make your own what they called crème fraîche by adding a little buttermilk or yogurt to heavy cream and making it thick. And in those days, cream was very chic. Nowadays, people are afraid of it. But the flour is different, but you could, because the French, general French flour is softer. and more made for pastries. And you can perfectly well duplicate that by using part unbleached all-purpose flour with a little bit of plain bleached cake flour added to it, which softens the gluten content. And, of course, the meat cuts are different, but there were otherwise I didn't find anything too difficult or impossible to do.
What do you think the American attitude was toward French cooking when your book, Mastering the Art of French Cooking, came out?
Well, at that point, when Mastering the Art came out, French cooking was very much in vogue because we had the J.F. Kennedys in the White House and they had their wonderful French chef. And at the same time, people were beginning to be able to get easily over to Europe because air flights were available. Before, you had to go by boat and it just took so long that only the upper classes could go over there, or people on extended vacations. So suddenly, Europe became available and Americans were able to go over there and taste the food, and it became very chic and people were very much interested in it.
You became nationally famous in the United States for your cooking show. I read that your cooking show started because you were a guest on someone else's show when your book Mastering the Art of French Cooking mm-hmm. came out, and there was such a big response that they gave you your own show.
At that time when they did a book review, and I had to do something. You can't just talk about it. So I beat up some egg whites in a big copper bowl, that kind of thing that people have not seen before, and I made an omelet. And at that time, there were no cooking shows at all on television. And people said, well, why don't we have a cooking show? And so I did three pilots, and they got a lot of response because there weren't any on at that point, and French cooking was very much in vogue. So they said, let's try 13 shows and see how it goes. And at that time, also, public television was mostly talking heads. And they wanted to have something that was a little more lively. And it started in Boston, and then I think Pittsburgh was the first to pick it up, and then San Francisco, and finally New York. And so that's how it really started in.
Julia Child is my guest. Were your early shows live?
No, nothing was live, but the early shows, because we were very, very, very strict budget, it was really live on tape.
Mm-hmm.
And so once we started in, we didn't stop at all, unless there was a terrible disaster, and we only had about two or three, I think.
Tell me one of the terrible disasters.
Well, one time I was blanching some broccoli, and it was in a salad basket, which was lowered into a big kettle, and when I picked it up, my fork slipped and it all fell on the floor. I didn't pick it up and use it, so we did we did stop because it was a real mess. But every time we stopped, it would cost, several hundred dollars because it always took half an hour to get back again, and you'd have to pay overtime. And another time there was a short circuit on my microphone, and every time I touched the stove, the microphone would go and I'd clutch my breast. So we had to stop for that. But otherwise, we just didn't stop at all. Then people would say, well, I saw you drop that chicken on the floor, which, of course, I never did. All I did was flip a potato pancake into the stove, and then I put it back into the pan, and I said, well, if you're all alone in the kitchen, nobody will know. It's funny that people saw me do that to a chicken. Isn't that funny how people will say that?
So were there often mistakes in the actual show that you would recover from, thinking that, well,
yes,
this kind of thing happens all the time?
And I think some people would accuse me of doing things purposely, but anyone who's been in the kitchen knows that awful things happen all the time, and you just, if you're a cook, you have to make do with whatever happens.
An example of something that you made do with on the air?
Well, I think that potato pancake was about it.
Okay.
But not much terrible happened. But, I was just cooking as one normally would at home, which I think people rather enjoyed because it was informal.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the way most people cook at home anyway.
I'm sure you must have seen the Dan Aykroyd Saturday Night Live.
Oh yes, we have a tape of that. That's great fun.
What he'd always do is when he was doing you is take little nips of wine until he got really giddy while he was cooking.
I know, and then people accuse me of that too, which of course I know Frank Pryl of the New York Times said that he saw me pick up a bottle and drink out of it, which of course I would never do in public. But I think his book didn't sell very well, so I don't care. No, I would never. I mean, would be a very gauche thing to do in public, wouldn't it?
Julia Child is my guest. She has a new cookbook, and it's called The Way to Cook. I want to ask you what you think of nouvelle cuisine.
Nouvelle cuisine is through, I think. I think it has been very useful in that it released people from a straitjacket. Then we've gone into silly seasons and so forth. But one thing that was very useful is of paying attention to how the food looks on the plate to make it really attractive. Then I think that gets exaggerated, so something looks like a Japanese flower garden and the food looks fingered, which is not attractive. I think food should look like food, but it should be very appetizingly arranged.
When you say food looks fingered, what do you mean?
I mean, so you'd taken your thumb and sort of wet your thumb and put these little things all around the plate in the shape of petals and so forth. And I don't find that attractive because you know that they have been probably licking their fingers and putting it on the plate.
It was French cooking that got you started
mm-hmm.
as a cook. How much of your time is devoted now to French cuisine?
That's kind of hard to say because what is important to me about French cuisine is the techniques because they are the techniques of good cooking. It's hard to say when you say French cuisine what that means anymore. It used to mean the school of Escoffier in classical French cooking, but what everybody who has any training at all uses French techniques because those are the bases of good cooking.
One last question. Do you ever have disagreements with your doctor about what an appropriate diet for you is?
Absolutely not, because we use the same system of moderation in all things, a great variety of foods, and weight watching, exercise, sensible helpings. But I'm a very good advertisement for my own cooking. I'm 77 years old, work a 10-hour day, eight days a week, and I'm just in very good form and health.
Well, I'm really glad to hear it, and I thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, good to talk with you. Bye.
Julia Child's latest book is The Way to Cook. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, David Crosby and Graham Nash of the band Crosby, Stills, and Nash. They've got a new album and are on a tour that marks their 21st year of performing together. I hope you can join us.
I was with you, you were alone. Now I'm standing here. Wisdom came only after you've gone. So I'm starting all over with a tear in my eye. I just never thought that you'd disappear. In the night, your image arises. Close behind comes the pain. I hope I'm dreaming, cause it hurts so bad. When I reach out for you, I'm alone in some room. I just never thought.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Randy Shiltz has covered the AIDS epidemic since 1982, and his 1987 book, And the Band Played On, remains one of the most comprehensive examinations of the politics of AIDS. Coming up, Randy Shiltz surveys the current state of the disease and medical research, and he tells us why he's decided to stop writing about AIDS. Also, Bruce Willis is back on the screen, making wisecracks while taking out terrorists. Film critic Owen Gleiberman has the review of Die Hard 2. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Conservative communists lashed out at the Soviet leadership's foreign policy today, calling it a myth. Mikhail Gorbachev's notion of a common European home. The comments came during a closed-door session of the 28th meeting of the Soviet Communist Party Congress. Ben Rowe reports from Moscow.
Gorbachev's new thinking came under fire from party military officials today in a working group on international policy. According to Soviet sources, one delegate argued that recent Soviet diplomatic gains were due to the government's ability to give in. Another said that permitting the revolutions in the East Bloc only meant that the Soviet Union had been effectively pushed out of Europe. Foreign ministry officials dismissed the charges, saying that the country's perestroika policies had denied the West the chance to portray the Soviet Union as the enemy of the people. Similar wrangling took place in other sessions as delegates broke up into small policy working groups designed to hammer out differences between radicals and conservatives on political and economic issues. For National Public Radio, I'm Benjamin Rowe in Moscow.
A federal appeals court has refused to resolve a controversy over the exclusion of two black religious leaders from the drug and perjury trial of Washington, D.C. Mayor Marion Barry. But the judge in charge of the case, Judge Thomas Penfield Jackson, is now indicating that he may relent and allow Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan and Imani Temple founder George Stallings to attend the trial. NPR's Nina Totenberg has more.
Last week, Judge Jackson barred Farrakhan and Stallings from the trial because the judge said their presence was potentially disruptive and very likely intimidating. Today, the U.S. Court of Appeals stopped short of intervening to reverse the judge and instead ordered him to hold a hearing on the matter. The appeals court said pointedly that the judge has complete control over seating arrangements in the courtroom and can change those arrangements at any time. But the court also said the judge may not exclude any individual from the courtroom solely because of the individual's point of view, even if that point of view may be regarded as antithetical to the fair administration of justice. Nor, said the appeals court, may anyone be excluded because his presence is thought to send an undesirable message to the jurors. Judge Jackson has scheduled a hearing tomorrow morning. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
The body of homeless advocate Mitch Snyder was found today at a shelter for the homeless in Washington, D.C., an apparent suicide. Snyder's death followed by days a major defeat as D.C. City Council voted to curb the city's landmark 1984 measure, which guaranteed emergency shelter for anyone in need. Snyder had recently said that he would challenge that decision in court. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 32 points to close at 2,879.21, volume 128 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Randy Shiltz is considered the foremost journalist writing about AIDS. He's written about AIDS since the early days of the epidemic and was the first journalist to cover the AIDS beat full-time. That was at the San Francisco Chronicle. He's also the author of the groundbreaking 1987 book And the Band Played On, an investigation into politics and the AIDS epidemic. Shiltz covered the 6th International Conference on AIDS last month in San Francisco and wrote several columns about it. In one of them, he described this as the new era of bad feelings.
I think what we've had in the last year is an increasing polarization between the activist and the scientist. I think that there's on one hand, I guess what we have to do is backtrack for what these conferences used to be like. I remember in the first International AIDS Conference in 1985 in Atlanta, it was a time when everybody got together and sort of patted each other on the back, and people congratulated each other, and for the problems that existed, people would sit down and they commiserate with each other about all the problems. There is a sense that we were all in this together. I think what we've seen in the past couple of years is an increasing polarization between the researchers and the activist community. And part of it, I think the reason for this polarization is the good news that's happening, that people who are affected by HIV and this disease are being told increasingly by researchers that, you know, we're going to get medical solutions to AIDS, we're going to find treatments that work. But the trouble is, year after year goes by, and these treatments are very slow in arriving, and so that creates a lot of frustration.
What do you think are some of the most interesting health research developments that have happened recently?
Oh, it's very exciting, the stuff that came out of this conference. And it's a shame it was almost overshadowed by the protest, because there's neat science going on. First of all, the area that was the most exciting this year at the AIDS conference was around vaccine research. Mm-hmm. I remember at the International AIDS Conference 2 years ago in Stockholm, there were eminent scientists predicting that we would never have an AIDS vaccine, that it was possible that we'd never get a vaccine. Now, just 2 years later, and at this conference, the opinion really gelled that most researchers, just about everybody working in vaccine research, believes that not only are we going to get an AIDS vaccine, but that we'll have an AIDS vaccine by the end of this decade. The second area of good news is on looking for AIDS treatments. Now, when we talk about treatments for AIDS, very few researchers ever use the word cure, which is something that sort of wipes out a disease. What they talk about are treatments, that is, long-term treatments. And the trend really started last year, but it's more pronounced this year, where researchers are getting very optimistic that the day will come when AIDS is a chronic, manageable disease. That is, AIDS will be something like diabetes, where it's something that being infected with the AIDS virus, there's going to be something always wrong with you, but rather than have it be something that kills you, it's something that will be medically managed over a long period of time.
So there are new drugs in the wings that would...
There's lots of antiviral drugs, and finally we're starting to see the designer drugs. You see, the drugs being used right now on AIDS, drugs such as AZT and the new drugs DDI and DDC, were drugs that were originally invented for cancer, and they sort of took them off the shelf. They found in the test tube that they worked against the AIDS virus, so now they're putting them in people. But what we're seeing now is the generation of designer drugs come up. These are drugs that have been designed in order to hamper and stop the various reproduction processes of the AIDS virus itself. Now, the more specific the drug is, the better designed it is, the more effective it will be, and hopefully the less toxic it will be to other cells in the body. So this generation of designer drugs is now coming to the point where they're going to be hopefully getting wide-scale testing, and then we'll be able to get some real serious life extension. So I know when I talk to people now who, you know, they say, well, I don't want to take the AIDS test because there's nothing I can do, or they test positive and they say, oh my God, I'm going to die. I just tell them that's no longer a scientifically reasonable assumption to have, because scientifically the advances are coming, and most researchers say that now we're not more than 4, 5, 6 years away of really finding that medical solution to HIV.
The only drug that's been approved by the FDA for treating the AIDS virus is AZT. Is there a feeling that the FDA should be moving quicker on certain drugs?
Well, a couple of years ago, much of the frustration was focused at the FDA. But I think what you've got to remember is the FDA is a very passive agency. What they do is sit in Bethesda and say, bring us evidence that your drug works, and we'll decide whether or not to approve it. They do not create drugs. They do not test drugs. They're strictly a regulatory agency. And actually, in the last couple of years, the FDA has significantly speeded up its a release and access to AIDS drugs. The real problem now, the bottleneck, is not in the FDA, but at the National Institutes of Health, which is supposed to be running the test that determine whether or not the drugs actually work or not. Because remember, it doesn't do any good to let everybody have a drug, to release a drug, unless we know whether it really does work, unless we have some sense of what the toxicities, the side effects are. And that's where the real problem is. I mean, at this conference that just came out of San Francisco, I mean, now they're researching like 100 drugs that either stop the AIDS virus or that stop or stop the infections that are associated with AIDS. This gets to the area that's very problematical, is that here on the scientific front, we have a lot of excitement about the breakthroughs we're making in treatment research and vaccine research. The trouble is on the political front, the resources are not being allocated in order to take advantage of the headway we're making in science and get the and translate it into concrete help for people who are suffering from HIV infection. And this is the real problem.
I read that in San Francisco there's been protests against what's been called the San Francisco model of treating patients, which is largely relying on a lot of volunteers. And I read that the volunteer ranks are exhausted and people want more government money to replace the volunteers with paid workers. What can you tell us about that?
The San Francisco model of AIDS care is, as you said, it's a combination of using sort of a minimal amount of city employees and then working through community-based organizations who mobilize large numbers of volunteers. And I think what the experience of AIDS shows is that the San Francisco model of dealing with AIDS is extremely successful in almost any city except San Francisco and New York. The problem that you're seeing in both San Francisco and New York at the present time is that most of the volunteers, probably 80% of the volunteers, came from the gay community. So the people who are volunteering 4 and 5 years ago are either burned out themselves, either most commonly they've been diagnosed themselves with AIDS, or let's say their lover has got AIDS, and so instead of going out and taking care of a stranger, that person who once volunteered is now taking care of their lover or their best friend. And so the volunteer base has been profoundly depleted. In fact, I don't think any of these organizations would be able to run, certainly in major urban areas, if it weren't for large numbers of lesbians who've now started volunteering in AIDS groups. If it weren't for the lesbians, everything would fall apart in San Francisco. So what is the transition that needs to happen is either government agencies are going to have to start picking up the responsibilities that have thus far been handled by volunteers, or we're going to have to find a new base of volunteers. That means that heterosexuals are going to have to start working in this disease. And I think there certainly have been many examples of individual heroics among people outside of the gay community. But as of yet, we have not seen a significant infusion of volunteers from other segments of the population to really pick up the slack.
I'm wondering if you expect to see a lot of protests in the near future against the immigration policies that officially keep out homosexuals and people with AIDS. This was the big subject at the recent AIDS conference, and some groups boycotted the conference because of it.
Now, America is one of the only countries in the world that bars HIV-infected people from its shores. To give you an example of the other countries that do this, is the People's Republic of China, and this policy is most popular among Islamic republics such as Iran and Kuwait. And so we're sort of following rules that the Ayatollah would be very, very proud of. This has made us sort of an outcast among other nations in terms of how we deal with foreigners or people who are HIV infected. I think the 1992 AIDS conference was scheduled for Boston. It will be moved out of the United States shortly if the United States government doesn't change its policy. The International AIDS Society, which sponsors the conference, has decided that. Harvard University, a co-sponsor of the 1992 conference, has said, we won't sponsor this conference as long as it's going to take place in a country, in Boston, where this happens. And so I think, in terms of protest, I think the wave of militants that we've seen grow in the last couple of years around AIDS has only begun. And I don't think it's going to be around the immigration issue so much as around the issue of treatments. I think you've got to remember that in recent years, the trend has been certainly in the gay community, and that's really the organizing base for these protests, that within the gay community, the trend has been that people are taking the HIV antibody test. They're finding out they're infected with the AIDS virus. And so suddenly these issues of how we test our drugs and how AIDS drugs get approved, these issues which once seemed very abstruse and the province of obscure bureaucrats in Washington, all of these of a sudden these distant issues become very close at hand because they're going to be the issues that decide whether or not you live or die. People aren't in the mood for candlelight marches anymore, and I think we're just starting to see the beginning of the militants that will exist if we don't start to see a mobilization on the part of the government.
My guest is journalist Randy Schiltz. He's covered AIDS since the early days of the epidemic, and he wrote a groundbreaking book on the politics of AIDS called And the Band Played On. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Mm-hmm.
Journalist Randy Schultz is my guest.
Right before we started our interview, you told me something that really surprised me, which is that you plan to stop covering AIDS.
Yeah. I've been writing about AIDS for 8 years now. When I first wrote my first AIDS story, it was in April of 82, there were 330 cases of AIDS. As I covered the conference last week, there's now 137,000 cases. Just as a journalist, I just can't keep on doing it. It sounds real corny, but when you start having nightmares where you wake up in the middle of the when you're in having nightmares and you're wandering around people's funerals and wandering around graveyards screaming, I can't take it anymore, I take that as a subconscious indication that maybe I shouldn't be covering this story. And so I felt a profound moral responsibility to cover the story at a time when nobody else was covering it and other people weren't willing to write about it and weren't willing also to rock the boat and be obnoxious and aggressive to government officials, which I think is an appropriate thing for a newspaper reporter to do. Personally, I'm just very burned out. You know, I am gay. I live in the gay community of San Francisco. You know, to spend all day writing about a disease and then get off work and then have to go home where half of my friends are dying of this disease, I've just found it a little bit much at this point. So I'm going to be pulling back from this. And I'm starting a new book in the fall, and that's what I'll be doing.
How has your job changed over the years in terms of covering AIDS? I mean, as you say, you started when so few people were writing about it.
Oh, no, and I remember when I wrote my first story about AIDS in 1982, we got the majority of surviving AIDS patients in San Francisco in one living room, and I interviewed them. Now you'd need Candlestick Park to get your surviving AIDS patients from San Francisco. I mean, it's changed so much. The story is very different in how vast it is. You know, when I first covered it, it meant going down to Castro Street. But within a couple of years ago, I was going to Uganda and certainly spending a lot of time in Washington figuring out how the government was responding. So much has changed in terms of the scope of the problem and, you know, the thousands and tens of thousands of people who are now working on it. What's depressing about it, or I should say what's angering about it, is how, in a very profound way, the basic storyline has not changed at all. That the story of AIDS remains a story of a huge problem and a response to it, which is not even remotely commensurate to the scope of the problem. And that continues to be the story. So today, you know, when I was writing about AIDS at the beginning, there was hundreds of thousands of dollars being spent on hundreds of cases. Today I write about AIDS and there's $1 billion or $2 billion being spent on hundreds of thousands of cases, and it's still not enough. And of course, the legacy of all the years of not dealing with it have taught us one thing, is that all of those unheeded warnings and all of those lost opportunities in the end add up to one thing, and that's dead bodies and, you know, suffering that didn't need to happen.
You were, to my knowledge, the first openly gay journalist who was writing about AIDS. And was affiliated full-time with a newspaper. And then you went on to become the most famous journalist who was writing full-time about AIDS. And you were openly gay. So I remember when your book and The Band Played On came out, your book about AIDS, you were on this really big media tour. And when I saw you, I think you were bracing yourself for, like, every radio and television interviewer to say, so tell me, do you test HIV positive? I'm sure you got asked that a lot, and I want to know how you dealt with it, if you thought, you know, assuming that you thought it was really, like, not relevant to the story.
Well, yeah, I mean,
what was the way of telling people no? I mean, telling people that you didn't want to answer that, yeah.
My basic way of, is I feel that the only people who have a right to ask me that question are people going to bed with me. And so usually the people who asked me that question were guys. They were always, men would ask if I were. So I say, well, you know, you have a right to know if you're going to bed with me. So is that a question or a proposition? It's sort of like when somebody asked me this came up in some of the early interviews, they'd make a comment about, so you're practicing homosexual. And I always felt, well, after all these years, I really stopped practicing and I'm just perfect at it now.
Oh, one-liners can really come in handy.
Yeah. They always work.
So was there a kind of like last straw for you that made you say, okay, I'm going to do it, I'm going to stop writing about AIDS? I bet it's something you had really thought about for a while, but you finally reached the point where you said, okay, I'm going to do it.
It's funny because intellectually I never got burned out. It is an exciting story. I mean, it's very interesting. It's very sad, but it's very interesting as to watch, especially having covered it from the very beginning and watching it all unfold as an international historic event. But, I mean, it was really with me. It was never a conscious thought. It was just I started having horrible nightmares, and every night it'd be HIV nightmares and just horrible things. And then so when I went back, I took some time off, and I've been both of my books are in development. development as movies. So I was in L.A. for a while, and I came back to San Francisco to cover the conference. The first night I was back at the Chronicle, I got a headache that lasted 18 days until I was done with the conference. And so sort of my body telling me things. It's just a level of intense burnout that I think a lot of people get with this, and who have to deal with this disease all the time.
Can you give us your overall evaluation of mass media coverage of AIDS?
I think in terms of dealing with the scientific aspect, it's been very good. What people remember, appreciate enough, was that this was an area where there could have been incredible hysteria, incredible homophobia, a lot of anti-gay backlash. And on the whole, we had really relatively little of that when you consider the scope of the problem. And I think it's because the media was very responsible, not only about talking how AIDS could be spread, but how it could not be spread. And I think the media tended to take a very compassionate tone, usually in dealing with this disease. So I'd give it high marks on the science and medicine of AIDS. Where I think there's always been a problem, and there continues to be a problem today, is dealing with the politics and the policy aspects of this. You know, when you look at I don't believe there is any major newspaper in the United States other than the Chronicle that went through and looked at the Bush budget and what it meant for AIDS, and also looked at the fact that the Bush budget cutters at the Office of Management and Budget cut by 50% the funds that the government's own experts, that the scientists at the National Institutes of Health, at the Centers for Disease Control, said they needed to fight this disease. And, I mean, it blows my mind that you've got a problem that's so vast, and the Washington Post doesn't bother to write about what's going on in Washington, D.C. regarding, you know, AIDS spending and AIDS policy decisions at the top of the government. You know, they'll cover the sexy things. You know, last week it was immigration, so they covered that. But they only are responsive. It's like the national editors of this country are brain dead when it comes to dealing with, you know, doing enterprise investigative reporting of the federal government's response to AIDS. And it's just as bad now as it was in 1983. And I don't know what's going to take to change it, you know, because they're just not doing it yet.
So when do you officially stop writing about AIDS? And are you going to be doing anything to mark that change in your life?
Yeah, well, pretty much I'm done now. The conference was my last bit at doing it, and so I'm hoping that I can stop now. And I'm going to be starting a new book shortly, and I've already started my preliminary interviews on it. So that's going to be it.
Okay, well, I wish you the best, and thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Journalist Randy Schiltz. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. Today we have news about the NATO summit in London, about the Soviet Communist Party Congress in Moscow. We also talk with an East Berlin resident about the difficulties that she faces every day now that a competitive economy has come to East Germany. News about growth hormones and what they can do for people, and also what genetic engineering can do for mice. Also have the letters from our listeners.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The ads promise Die Harder, but does the movie deliver? Guest film critic Owen Gleiberman has this review of Die Hard 2.
Well, John McClane is at it again. You remember McClane. He's the guy who specializes in one-man commando raids. In Die Hard, he went up against a terrorist who'd taken over a high-rise office building in Los Angeles. In Die Hard 2, the setting is Washington, D.C.'s Dulles Airport. There's another terrorist on the loose, an Ollie North-style renegade who takes command of the control tower electronically from a nearby church. It seems he's turned against the United States and is now working for a notoriously corrupt Central American dictator who's been arrested by the U.S. for drug trafficking. Sound familiar? This Noriega-like character is about to arrive in Washington, where the terrorist wants to intercept his plane and spirit him away to freedom. Unless the airport officials meet his demands, he's going to keep the incoming planes circling until they start running out of fuel and crashing into the Potomac. This plot is more than a little nutty, though you certainly couldn't accuse it of not being topical. Before McLean can get on with his kamikaze hijinks, he has to cut through the usual assortment of spineless bureaucrats and by-the-book cops. Here he is going head-to-head with a military officer who knew the terrorist before he went over the edge.
Let the pros handle this.
Yeah, well, it looks like the pros are on the wrong team tonight. Isn't Colonel Stewart one of your men?
No, not anymore, he's not. Now, we're here to take Colonel Stewart down, and we will take him down. You see, I served with him. I taught him everything he knows.
Well, maybe he's learned a few more things since then.
The first Die Hard was an exhilarating blowout. It took a certain audacity to set an entire 100-megaton thriller inside an office building, and Bruce Willis, who toned down his TV smirk, held the big screen with surprising authority. In Die Hard 2, Willis proves once again that he's a physically graceful action hero who can spit out Eastwood-style wisecracks with the best of them. And much of the movie has been staged with satisfying kinetic flair. There's one great comic moment when Willis gets blasted out of his airplane in an ejector seat. Yet something is missing. Die Hard was more than a series of well-staged action set pieces. It had a great villain, a suavely malicious German terrorist played to icy perfection by Alan Rickman. In Die Hard 2, the terrorist has no personality. All that's distinctive about him is that he does Tai Chi and looks like a troop leader of the Hitler Youth. And there's another problem. In Die Hard, that great big booby-trapped skyscraper made for a thrillingly concentrated action film. Willis kept crawling through catwalks and dropping through ceilings as though the entire building were his private jungle gym. In Die Hard 2, the action is so spread out, it no longer makes much sense that McLean could foil a terrorist master plan all by himself. Die Hard 2 strains to be every bit as gripping, funny, and explosive as the first Die Hard was. But the suspense comes in fits and starts this time. By the end, the movie stands revealed as little more than an updated version of that old 70s dinosaur, the disaster film.
Owen Glauberman is film critic for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, and Thad Kirk. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, two-thirds of the rock group Crosby, Stills, and Nash, David Crosby and Graham Nash, tell us how they met and why they're still making music together. Also, we meet comedian Tommy Davidson, a regular on In Living Color and the star of his own comedy special. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.